Mrs. Pittman. Schlammer.
Good morning. My name is Bryant Lamer. I'm appointed counsel for appellant Theodore Pittman. Mr. Pittman was found guilty of sending a fraudulent document to a federally insured bank in August of 2001. Mr. Pittman directly appealed that. As part of his appeal, Mr. Pittman argues, first, that the district court committed plain error by allowing prior crime evidence without conducting a four-factor analysis. Secondly, Mr. Pittman argues that his trial counsel's performance was constitutionally ineffective and he performed ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Pittman seeks a reversal, a remand, and a new trial.
Do you really want to pursue the argument that trial counsel was ineffective? And if you pursue it now, you're pursuing it on a record which does not show the total course of his performance or the reasons for his behavior, and it is therefore doomed. This court has been in existence for more than 110 years, and the number of ineffective assistance claims that have succeeded on direct appeal is zero. The probability of your being first is not large. But if you make the ineffective assistance claim now and you lose, you will not be able to make any ineffective assistance claim on a larger record on a collateral attack.
Mr. Pittman,
does your client understand this?
Yes, Mr. Pittman's appeal is solely based on the record as it stands now.
Yes. The question I'm asking is, does your client understand, has your client been told, that if he pursues this claim now, he cannot make a collateral attack based on ineffective assistance, even on an enlarged record,
yes,
or even with a different legal argument?
The client is aware of that.
And the client has been told that he is bound to lose now.
The client has not been instructed.
Told zero for 110 years are his odds.
The client was not instructed that it's zero for 110, but the client is aware that his...
Actually, 111 years.
111 years. The client is aware that his ineffective assistance claim is solely based on the record, and it will come now or not at all.
Today is the day.
Today is the day.
All right.
And he doesn't want to withdraw it.
Okay.
This case is essentially about two fraudulent facsimiles. The first one occurred in 1996, and the second one occurred in 1998. The one occurring in 1996 was sent from Mr. Pittman's home. Mr. Pittman sent it by reprogramming his fax machine, and it was sent to a federally insured bank, indicating collateral for a loan application. Mr. Pittman pled guilty to that offense and was sentenced in 1999. Another fax was sent from Mr. Pittman's home in 1998, and it was sent to a federally insured bank. At trial, the government sought to use Mr. Pittman's 1999 conviction as proof of intent, identity, motive, knowledge that Mr. Pittman had sent the fax in 1998 from his home by using his fax machine, by reprogramming his fax machine, and sending it to a federally insured bank. Mr. Pittman argues that the district court in this instance committed plain error by admitting the prior crime evidence without conducting a four-factor analysis. This court has held.
He wasn't asked to. I mean, that the problem with a plain error, you could say it was just so completely outside the scope of 404 that it was plain error not to admit it, but it's really not the trial judge's duty to put on the record a full-blown 404B analysis when no one asks her to.
This court has held before that 404B evidence is inherently prejudicial and has requested district courts in the past to conduct this analysis in the interest of judicial economy.
Not if nobody objects. Right? The reason why, if somebody objects and says, I don't want this evidence in, the judge then going to have to exercise some form of thoughtful discretion, whether a mechanical recitation of four factors or three or five and a half is irrelevant, but some thoughtful discretion. But if nobody objects, what business would it be of the district judge to effectively make an objection for the party and then evaluate it? lawyers often have strategic reasons for wanting evidence to come in.
I'll answer that in two parts.
Of course, we can't evaluate on this record whether the lawyer had such a strategic reason.
Well, first of all, I think it's clear from reading the record that the trial counsel did not have a strategy.
It's not clear to me. Nobody has asked the lawyer.
If you were to read through the record, it indicates that the trial strategy was...
Let me put it to you this way. Your client testified. His priors were going to come in for impeachment when he testified. One thing lawyers often do is allow priors to come in earlier so the jury isn't taken aback or by shock when they come in as impeachment for the testimony. Now, maybe that was the lawyer's thinking here, maybe it wasn't, but allowing priors to come in a case where once the client testifies, they're going to come in anyway, that doesn't seem outré.
Well, addressing your question in the second part, we believe it is the district court's duty to maintain the integrity of the judicial proceeding.
Well, it is at a very general level, but what you're arguing is that district court judges can never admit evidence without putting on the record the reason why the district judge has decided to let certain evidence in, whether or not there was an objection. And that has never been held before, at a minimum. There are all sorts of good reasons, as Judge Easterbrook has said. In an adversary system, you normally wait until there's an objection. And indeed, in this case, you may have even waived this point, because it looks to me like there's an exchange where the district judge is actually trying to find out if there's an objection and is told, no, we're not going to object, at which point that's the end of it. That's actual waiver as opposed to forfeiture.
We believe that Mr. Pittman did not waive this argument. First, waiver occurs by foregoing a right in order to receive a benefit. And by allowing in testimony which is prejudicial to Mr. Pittman, this is clearly not a benefit to Mr. Pittman in that regard.
Well, but as Judge Easterbrook says, we don't know. And waiver, you know, the intentional relinquishment of a known right, it can occur if the lawyer, at least in this kind of situation, 404B, if the lawyer says, we are not objecting to that, that's enough. Mr. Pittman is bound by what his lawyer said.
Even if this court believes that a waiver has occurred, this court
can review it then.
This court is allowed to review, it has the ability to review an argument on appeal if counsel's performance was ineffective. And in this instance, counsel's performance was ineffective.
0 for 111 years? You think this is the one that will finally succeed?
Agreed.
We don't know what the lawyer's rationale was, and when I've already articulated a plausible rationale, and on top of this, the Supreme Court has said that ineffective assistance requires consideration of the entire course of the lawyer's representation. It is not a sound argument to say the lawyer made mistake X, therefore ineffective assistance. And your brief doesn't even try to evaluate the entire course of performance of this counsel.
In this brief, we make an overall objection that Mr. Pittman's trial counsel failed to object at any point throughout the proceedings, save one objection concerning relevancy.
Yeah.
Mr. Pittman's trial counsel was given the opportunity to respond to the government's trial brief.
No, the critical questions for ineffective assistance are, was there a slam-bang defense that he didn't make? Did he fail to interview critical witnesses? Right. Did he misunderstand the law? Those are things that might actually be ineffective assistance. But if you've got a lawyer who's made all the good defenses, interviewed all the right witnesses, saying he didn't object to evidence is going to get you absolutely nowhere. But we don't know whether he made the right defenses or interviewed the right witnesses or prepared the case the way a competent lawyer would prepare it, because the record doesn't show any of those things.
Again, Your Honor, I would just reiterate that the record demonstrates that Mr. Pittman's trial counsel was aware that the government would be filing briefs, reserved time, but then didn't file anything. And then at the day of trial was asked whether he was going to do anything, and he said simply no. And the trial record also indicates, as you look through it, that he wasn't even paying attention during the trial. He was asked if he was going to object to evidence coming in, and he would come forward and say, oh, yes, I guess it's my turn. And in addition to that, there are numerous points throughout the trial proceedings where Mr. Pittman's trial counsel could have objected and failed to do so. And because of that prejudicial testimony, Mr. Pittman was convicted based on the jury's emotions and the propensity of Mr. Pittman to commit the crime. reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
And rest on my brief.
Thanks, Mr. Lammer.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Shea?
Good morning, Tim O'Shea for the United States. I would respectfully submit that Mr. Pittman's attorney was not constitutionally ineffective because the defendant hasn't shown that the evidence was, in fact, improperly admitted.
How can you tell whether he's constitutionally ineffective?
Wait. Well, I don't think that it came up now. I don't think it should have come up now, constitutional. But looking at the record now, we say, okay, was this evidence properly admitted? I think the only conclusion is, yeah, this, the 608B evidence and the 404B evidence was properly admitted. The 404B evidence, it showed. I mean, it showed his knowledge, his plan, his intent, knowledge how to reprogram these fax machines, and that gets into the whole modus operandi thing, the identity thing. And I've been doing this 12 years, and I've tried to follow this court's opinions pretty closely. I've never seen a fraudulent case where somebody reprogrammed a fax machine. That's a new one on me. And the knowledge of how to do that, I think, strongly shows that it was sort of a signature crime. The other things that would indicate that it's a signature crime is that in both crimes, the prior 1996 and then this crime, Mr. Pittman, it created a document which falsely claimed that he controlled certain collateral. As I said, he reprogrammed his fax machine. And also he sent a bogus document to banks to influence a lending decision. The defendant at trial, he was a little more subtle than on appeal, and he kind of alluded that perhaps his wife was the culprit, that she was really the mystery person that sent this fax to the Northwest Savings Bank. The defense on the reply brief, pages 4, and more specifically page 12, they say, hey, look, it was, you know, the jury could have found this. Had this evidence not come in, the 404B evidence, and had the 608B evidence not come in, they might have thought it was her. Well, that's just the point. This is crucial evidence. This is very probative evidence that it wasn't Doreen Pittman, that in fact it was the defendant, Mr. Pittman. So the probative value of this nature clearly was not substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And of course, the judge, Judge Crabb, appropriately instructed the jury so that it ameliorates any danger of unfair prejudice, as Judge Flom wrote in Jones. I believe you were on the case with the Asher case, Judge Wood, with they said, hey, we assume that jurors, you know, follow the instructions. And in the Asher case, the jury was told they could only consider those 13 cars as it related to his intent and knowledge and plan and all that. In your case with Mr. Jones, the jury was told that years of crack dealing they had to, they could only count for certain things. And I think the jury reasonably did that here. And so ID was the big thing. Of course, the other big thing in this case was whether or not Mr. Pittman told the truth when he got up there and testified. And Judge Flom wrote the Mansky opinion. This is garden variety,
you know,
in the middle.
It doesn't make any difference who writes the opinions of the court and who's on the panel.
Right.
The jurisprudence of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit.
Right.
Making in personam arguments to the panel is not a good appellate strategy.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I only refer to that because I know that the court is then, this particular judge is familiar with the facts, specific facts that. In any way, this Mansky case, the court describes three different ways to look at 608B, and this is middle of the road, garden variety, you know, stealing from people, and the government properly cross-examined Mr. Pittman, and of course his credibility was the crucial factor. On the record before us, this evidence should have come in. Consequently, Mr. Ryan was not constitutionally ineffective. I appreciate the court's attention. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea.
Thank you,
Mr. Lammer.
Government has indicated that the 404B evidence in no way harmed Mr. Pittman. There was no prejudice because of it. And it's not necessarily the point that Mr. Pittman committed a crime in 1996. In fact, the government could have used that evidence to just simply show that Mr. Pittman had sent a fax previously from his home by reprogramming his fax machine and sent it to a federally insured bank. Had they limited it to that, it may have been possible to allow it in. But nevertheless, the court allowed and the government brought in out the facts prior to Mr. Pittman testifying that Mr. Pittman had lied to previous investors, that he had lied to the FBI in his first visit, that he had failed to pay back his previous investors, that he had received judgments against him in the amount of $235,000, that he didn't pay his taxes, that he hadn't paid on the judgments that had been levied against him. These additional points, this extrinsic testimony that came with the baggage that came with the 404B is the baggage that led to the prejudice to Mr. Pittman. That is what the jury latched onto, and they were lured into convicting Mr. Pittman based on their emotions and the propensity.
Flamer, you know, perhaps in a different setting, that argument might have a greater thrust. Don't we have a significant amount of other evidence apart from the 404B?
There is a significant amount of evidence that would indicate that Mr. Pittman committed the crime. I would submit to the court that there is also a significant amount of evidence that would indicate that Mr. Pittman was not the individual who sent the fax from his home. And the government has not charged conspiracy in this case. They charged that Mr. Pittman was the individual who sent the fax from his home.
But didn't the signature match up?
The signature from Kent Slinger, who was an employee of Middleton Community Bank, matched up with the fraudulent document that was sent to Northwest Bank. But again, that document was found in, I see my time is running.
No, you may complete your thought.
That document was found in Mr. Pittman's home after Mr. Pittman had left his home. He no longer lived there, and it was found in Mr. Pittman's personal planner by Mr. Pittman's estranged wife, the individual who received $10,000 from the loan distribution. Based on those facts, it is possible, there's a significant probability that the outcome of the case would have been different. Thank you.
All right, thanks to both counsel. Mr. Lamer, I send you a special thanks on behalf